Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. This is a good time to think about community radio. We are moving into a fundraiser period here, and we want to thank you and encourage you to support this fine radio station. Here is some good advice from the Danilana Kitchen.
Yes, we have a recipe for good community radio station. In a big bowl, big enough to include ideas from everyone, add 1 cup each of creativity, energy, and cooperation. Add lots of determination and hard work. Mix well with talented staff and volunteers. Season liberally with dashes of humor and perseverance. Stir it all together. Pour the mixture into a baking pan big enough to hold an FCC license, and send it out on the radio.
And don't forget, the most important ingredient of all is you. Your support helps make sure that KHOI Community Radio stays on the air loud and clear. Now's a good time to become a member of KHOI or renew your membership. Go to www.khoifm.org and click the Become a Member button. You will be glad you did.
And we'll be glad you did also.
Very good. Should we do that again?
And sure. We can do the same thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, now we're back. Good. Today on the Danilana Kitchen, we're going to take a look outside our kitchen window and kind of consider some of our neighbors. There's an organization in this town in central Iowa here called the Iowa Wildlife Center. The Iowa Wildlife Center provides professional wildlife rescue, medical treatment, and rehabilitation of native wildlife in central Iowa, and it teaches about wildlife and habitat stewardship and provides wildlife assistance, skills, training. Joining us today from the Iowa Wildlife Center, Marlene Ehrsman and Jenna Mogg. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Good, good. We were talking a little bit about what we wanted to cover, and you mentioned that, and this is an important concept to you, human-wildlife conflict and coexistence is a topic worth talking about. Tell us about the Iowa Wildlife Center and the important work that you do.
Yeah, I mean, we live on a shared planet, right? And so we are not the only species on Earth, and we tend to forget about the wild companions around us, our wild neighbors. And so that's one of the things that we do is just try and give people a greater understanding of the natural world and see how we're distancing ourselves from it rather than maintaining the closeness we've historically had with it. Lana, I know you and your garden and things, you are out where you see wildlife around you all the time, and your interactions, you're probably closer to the earth than a lot of people might be who work in a downtown office space all the time and don't get outside. And that's not to say that's bad or good, it's just different. And so what we do is bring some of the wildness into people's lives and get them to not fear it, but to understand it better. Because once you understand something, you're not quite as afraid of it.
That's good. That's good because, I have made use of your telephone number, too, because there are questions when we interact with things. I remember many, many years ago, I called you because there was a swan walking on the road and actually kind of blocking traffic. And who would know about such things? We forget about the animals around us. So I assume people still call you with questions.
Oh, yes. And I'm going to let Jenna talk about some of the phone calls.
Oh, good.
We get hundreds of calls every year, hundreds and hundreds, and we're going into our busy season now. So Jenna's been really busy. Part of our education is that one-on-one phone call. It's not just a phone call to us. It's an educational opportunity to share natural history about the species they're calling about and to determine if the animal really needs help. So Jenna can jump in and talk about some of the calls we get and some of the reasons wildlife has so much, I guess, we call them wildlife woes. And so it's often human caused. And so Jenna could talk to you about some of the phone calls she's been getting recently and some of the traumas that they experience and some of the things we can do.
Good. Jenna, you're a relatively new employee, but already Marlene's put you to work. So tell me what sort of things you're doing on the phone.
Wait a minute. I forgot to introduce her. So yes, thank you.
No, I said Jenna, but anyway, go ahead and introduce her.
I know, but I just keep dropping her into situations. She started full time with us October 1st. So she's not been with us all that long, but she's just been an immense help as a full time staff employee here as the wildlife patient manager. So now I'll let her take it, but she's awesome and I want the community to get to know her.
So a lot of the phone calls we've been getting lately pertain to babies that people are finding in their yards, in particular like squirrels, infant squirrels that they find either on sidewalks or at the base of trees. So we can go through if the mom's around and reunite and re-nesting opportunities. And that's not just for squirrels. That's for some other animals too, like baby birds and other phone calls we get too. There'd be injuries associated with it. Often they're human caused injuries, like they're hit by a car. We get that a lot with turtles that are just trying to cross the road, and now turtles are crossing the road looking for mates. And then also window collisions, or there are just babies found in window wells, caught by cat or dog attacks. Those are often the baby bunnies that are found in the yard. And then also just kind of diseases, sick individuals that they find roaming around. So lots of different topics that I hear phone calls about every day. I think right now we're upwards of 10 to 20 phone calls a day.
Oh, my. Oh, okay. Is this the good advice that my mother always said? If you see a baby something or other, do not touch it, right?
So it depends.
It depends. Okay, good.
So the first thing I usually go through with people is, okay, you found an animal. Can you explain what the animal looks like so we know what species we're working with? That will help determine what we should be looking for next. And then do you see any apparent injuries? So do you see any blood or exposed bone, anything we need to be concerned about immediately? If it appears to be healthy and we know what it is, say it's a squirrel, a baby squirrel, and we're eyes closed, which means we definitely still need mom, the best thing for any baby in the wild is to have mom. So we want to try to reunite if we can, or re-nest if the nest got destroyed. So we're in spring, or what is Iowa spring right now. And so spring cleaning, a lot of people want to go outside and cut down trees or clean out their gutters. And so we just want to caution people when you're doing that to make sure that you are aware of the surroundings. So if there are nests nearby, then you want to see if they're vacant nests, or if they're occupied, let's wait until they're not vacant anymore. Maybe let's do a fall cleaning instead of spring cleaning. or cutting down trees in the fall rather than in the spring when we're having all these babies. So of an infant squirrel on the ground, we want to see, is there a nest up above? Did we fall at the base of a tree? You want to check that tree first. And then if there is a nest, what can you access the nest? If not, can you get a like an Easter wicker basket and fill it with some leaf litter and secure that to the tree or secure a box to the tree so we can get that infant in that tree for mom to bring it back to the nest. You can play infant distress calls as well to coax the mom to come in. But we just want to forewarn people to kind of step back if you're going to be playing those distress calls. That way you're not scaring mom off from coming to access.
Good. Good advice. My goodness. And heaven knows it's spring. Everything seems to be getting born. And we were discussing...
One thing I think you might have been getting to also is the scent.
Yeah, the
human
scent.
Right? So right. Yes, our mother tell us to leave it alone. And she did that for two reasons, I'll bet. One was because maybe disease or parasites. Uh-huh. And the other one would be that the mother of that species would not claim her baby again because of the human scent. Now, the latter one is not true. The maternal instinct in these species is, and it's almost throughout all the species, is so strong that even in mammals, that maternal drive will outweigh that human scent. You don't want to keep them away, you know, and cuddle them and everything for days. That won't be good. But that's a myth. The moms will take them back.
Uh-huh.
And birds don't have a real strong sense of smell, so they'll take them back as well. As far as the disease, we always caution kids especially to always go find an adult before they try and rescue something. And then the adult can call us and see, then we can walk them through just what Jenna was describing. Mm-hmm. Just making sure that the animal really does need to be rescued and then what they might do to help reunite it. So parasites, most of the animals that come in have fleas or mites or things. And so there are reasons to not handle these animals barehanded. So, yep.
Good.
So those are the little animals. What about all the foxes that we have here in Ames? They have provided much amusement for my household where they, at night, they run up and down the streets, especially there's a throughway, I think, on 8th Street where it must be coming from the river to Brookside Park or something between the two rivers. And my dog just sits and barks at the windows all night long because they really enjoy seeing the foxes come. So we in the last few years, we've had a lot of foxes in Ames, right?
Oh, absolutely. We get calls frequently about various fox families in Ames. And sometimes they're adult fox that have been hit by a car and they may have a broken leg or something. Sometimes once in a while they suffer from mites that cause mange, which is usually a disease that we need to, capture the animal and treat it for the mange. So right now there are kits around, baby fox, and they're just starting to come out of the nest and wander around. And so people need, usually the parents, the adults tell their kits to stay home. You know, they're not old enough to be out running around learning to hunt yet. So the parents are out usually at, you know, dusk through the night hunting, and they take a lot of rabbits. We have a real high population of rabbits in Ames because we have the right food, water, and shelter. And the fox are helping keep the population of rabbits down. So I'll bet we have the same fox family running between your house, Donna, and mm-hmm. our house, the Brookridge. And we
yeah.
we know that those adults are capturing rabbits to take back to those youngsters.
There is one that limps up and down the street. Have you seen that one?
I've heard about it.
Yeah.
And I've seen some footage. And so I was just going to say that foxes are really canids are really smart. and it's really difficult to live trap these animals to get them in for treatment. Anytime a wild animal comes in for treatment into our situation, they're really stressed out because we're predators to every one of these animals. And so it's a really stressful situation. And if we don't need to bring them in, and we probably don't stand a really good chance at fixing it properly, then we just try and work with the people and the animal, and just to have people watch the animal and make sure that it is recovering on its own terms. It may have a limp, but bones heal. And there are wild animals out there across the landscape all the time that are injured. And if they have enough food available within a short area around them and don't have to hunt hard, if they have water, if they have places to hide, sometimes within, you know, a matter of a couple of weeks, they can regain enough health to start wandering a little further. Bones heal. So in that case, it was just best left on its own. And it did heal enough. It just, like me, has a permanent limp from a broken leg.
Very good. But yeah, we are kind of very similar. And other things that we usually find in town, well, many things are finding their way into town. I often wonder about interactions with domestic pets like raccoons and opossums. And raccoons can be rather big and aggressive. I don't know about you, but I've had some that kind of let me know that I shouldn't be trying to shoo them away, and they kind of turn. We have to be reminded that they can defend themselves if they have to. They can be
right.
Yeah.
And again, this time of year, they have babies, and we get particularly defensive with babies, you know, and we would too. So I always tell people to give things space. Now, if they end up like in your attic and have babies in your attic and you want them out, if you don't want them someplace, then there are ways we can work with people to get them to move out of the attic on their own, because just denning animals like squirrels or raccoons, they like it dark, right? You think about a den. They like it dark. They like it to smell like them, and they like it quiet. So you do everything possible to make it just the opposite. You yank away the welcome mat that an attic provides or a crawl space, and you put in bright LED lights and run those 24 hours a day for several days. You put in talk radio. That is really helpful. And you can soak rags with a vinegar solution and put them in a plastic bag, punch holes in the plastic bag, and throw that in your attic or around in your crawl space or whatever. That is yanking away the welcome mat. And be sure not to feed your domestic animals outside. Don't leave your dog and cat kibble outside at night. That's like really a welcome mat. That's the dining room table.
Yeah, that'll bring the mice too, and the chipmunks and everything.
That is,
and the fox and all of that.
That is good advice. I remember using the same sort of advice about, we had a woodchuck living under our farm shed, and again, a rather large creature. I'm sure it wouldn't be too aggressive, but I'm not going to stick my hand in there and get it out of there. So yes, I took your advice and I put lights down there and some smelly things, and talk radio does work. However, Marlene, I did put talk radio. I ran a radio out into my garden once because I wanted to keep whatever was either woodchucks or raccoons, and I went out one morning and the radio was unplugged. So they obviously didn't like the station. I plugged it in again. But these are smart creatures. These are smart creatures. Yes, they are. Oh goodness.
So we just try and learn their natural history as best we can, and then work with that animal based on its how it likes to move across the landscape.
Ah, that's true. Woodchucks can't see very well, can they? Some animals follow their nose and some animals follow their eyes. Moving into gardening season, my antenna are alert to what are the woodchuck woodchucks and rabbits doing? So, yeah, you learn to live with them. They're going to be there. Good, good. What about bigger things? Of course, deer come into town, too. You would think that local dogs and stuff and the traffic and why are the deer coming into town?
Well, good, and again, it all has to do with food, water, and shelter. These animals, well, they were here first, for starters, but we still provide, urban landscapes can provide a lot of good habitat for these wild animals to survive in, and deer is one of them. And Jenna will talk a little bit about some of this.
Oh, good.
Well, and does will often have their fawns adjacent to human populated areas because we're predators. So that is kind of like a warning to any other predators of deer to stay away. They're not going to want to come in towards a human populated area. So that actually works out for a doe's benefit for her young. So you'll find the fawns curled up. And so unfortunately, currently, we have chronic wasting disease, so that kind of puts our hands tied as to what people are allowed to do. So since February of 2018, it's been illegal for wildlife rehabilitators to handle any age of white-tailed deer due to chronic wasting disease, since it is highly spreadable between the individuals within that species.
Goodness.
So how does that affect hunters then?
There's not been any documented crossover of the prion that causes chronic wasting disease transmitting to humans yet. So things can change, but everyone's across the nation's watching it pretty closely. And like anything, hunters are always cautioned to use precautions when they're handling game that they've harvested, using rubber gloves and things to do the dressing and packaging of the meat and things like that. So, I mean, you always, knowledge is power, I think. And so it's up to the hunter to learn, about the prey that they're going after and any of the possible dangers that they might encounter. So one thing that we do with fawns, we had back just before this mandate from the DNR came down that we couldn't handle fawns or adults for that matter. Adults we don't want to handle because they can be really dangerous, but they also easily die of what we call capture myopathy, and they just basically have a heart attack because it's such a stressful situation for them. Adult rabbits are fairly similar that way. But the fawns we had, we were developing a reuniting and fostering program with the fawns. We don't want these baby animals. We don't want any of these animals coming to us for any reason, right? We just don't. And we certainly don't want the babies coming to us because like Jenna alluded to a while ago, they raise their own kind much better than we humans think we can raise these animals. They teach them all the language and the behaviors that are inherent in who that animal is. So with the fostering and reuniting, we would take the baby, the fawn, after it was nourished and everything, back out into an area where we thought the mother was, or where there was a high population of deer. And then we would play a distress call from a fawn. And so that can bring in, it's pretty remarkable how many does will come running to that area thinking it's their fawn.
Oh, really? See, you know what to do. How good.
But you can't do that anymore. Is that
well,
right?
No. But so what we arm callers with, since we can't intervene like that, is that you can download distress calls for fawns, and this is going to sound weird, from predator hunting sites. So like from coyote hunters, they'll play a distress call of a fawn, hoping to call in a predator for them to kill. So we can turn that around and play a distress call of a fawn, hoping that a doe will come in and adopt this fawn. And Iowa does are really healthy and corn-fed, of course, so they can have up to 3 fawns and do okay. So definitely 2 fawns and definitely a single if they've lost their fawn.
Well, I'm so glad you know what to do. It sounds like animals are, well, I shouldn't say smarter than we thought, but they're as smart as we thought and maybe even more. I want to mention this is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. And I want to mention that this is fundraising time. Support this fine radio station. Become a member. Go to khoifm.org. You can find out a whole lot about this fine radio station. And when you're there, press the donate button. Be part of this organization. This is community radio. It is a treasure. So help us stay on the air. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking to Marlene Ehrsman and Jenna Mogg from the Iowa Wildlife Center. We've got lots of animal stories and animal questions.
Were talking about the chronic wasting disease. There's another terrible thing going on. Tell us about how avian influenza has affected your work.
Yeah, definitely. I'll get to that in just a second. I'm going to have Jenna go over just quickly about what people should do if they find a fawn alone.
Sure, go ahead.
And then we'll wrap that discussion up.
So for fawns, if you find them, you'll want to wait for at least 6 hours and just leave the fawn alone. Don't try interacting with it or touching it or anything. Because it can take up to 3 days before the fawn will actually get up and start searching for food if it is truly orphaned. They can also start vocalizing their distress calls, shivering. They may have a bony appearance or appear stressed. They can have the tips of their ears can appear drooped or folded, showing dehydration. So the options for that, and it sounds harsh, but just because of the chronic wasting disease, is you can leave it alone and see if it succumbs on its own, or you can play distress fawn calls to just further enhance the current fawn's distress calls if he's making any. To try to coax in a mom, the foster, or you can contact the local county conservation officer or DNR officer for a field euthanasia.
Or in Ames, it can be the police officers too. So, and I would probably go through our local animal control, Ron Edwards and staff, and they would then arrange for something like that. So fawns are left alone for the first 3 days. They're told by their moms to stay, and at that age, they do a really good job of staying, laying down, and hiding and being still. That's why people stumble on them when they're mushroom hunting. And so just leaving it alone and backing away, the mom's usually in the area. And so all of this other information is what happens if the mom has been killed or otherwise is not able to get to her fawn. So, yeah. So back to the HPAI, Donna.
Mm-hmm.
So when I attended the National Wildlife Rehabilitators Association symposium last spring, a year ago, that was in Madison, Wisconsin, and that was the first time I had heard that this country had an outbreak of highly pathogenic avian influenza. And so it was so new that we didn't even have it scheduled to be talked about at the symposium. And so they had a special session toward the end of the symposium just to talk about it and what it might mean to rehabilitators, particularly rehabilitators of birds. But even at that point, there had been, I think, one mammal species that had been found to have contracted highly pathogenic avian influenza. So fast forward to this year at the symposium Jen and I went to out in Delaware, and there was an entire, well, several sessions on HPAI. And what we've been experiencing here in Ames, we really wanted to get a handle on this. And the Iowa DNR has been doing a great job. And the DNR wildlife veterinarian, Rachel Rudin, has held meetings for wildlife rehabilitators, Zoom meetings for wildlife rehabilitators to apprise us of the current situation statewide and tell us how we could handle intake of these birds. We need to have special state permits to handle all species and to handle birds that are protected by the Migratory Treaty Act. In other words, all of our native birds, we have to have a federal permit as well. Hmm. So rehabilitators who are taking in birds in particular really need to have a place to isolate and quarantine birds just to make sure that it doesn't have highly pathogenic avian influenza. Some of the birds, especially the waterfowl, can carry it. Canada geese in particular can carry it and not be symptomatic. In other words, we don't see huge symptoms of illness in them, but they can still spread it to other Canada geese and other waterfowl and shorebirds. And as it turns out, if we have predators coming in, scavengers like the bald eagle, taking advantage of these dead and dying waterfowl, they can contract it really easily, and they typically die within 24 hours. So one of our projects this winter was to gather some of our volunteers that had ice rescue training and water rescue training, and we collected all the carcasses off of Ada Hayden that we could. And we collected around 50 Canada goose carcasses. Wow. And a couple of trumpeter swans, and a couple of mallards, but they turned out they did not have HPAI. They had some other waterfowl disease. So we tried to minimize the spread by removing the carcasses, and our partner in that was Ames Animal Control. So they would then take we were suited up against having the fomites and everything. It can be passed through saliva and feces. And so, we changed our boots. We made sure that when they went home, that they would wash and disinfect their footwear and their clothes and everything, so they wouldn't transfer it to any chickens or anything they might have on their site. And so we bagged all the carcasses, double bagged the carcasses, and then transferred them to Ames Animal Control, who then had them incinerated immediately. We already knew, we worked with Dr. Rudin on this, and she sent away the carcasses of the first five Canada geese that we had collected, and they definitely had HPAI. Mm. So we knew it was on the site, and so we just kept removing, assuming that any dead or dying bird out there probably had HPAI. And currently we know that there had been, I think, a couple of crows that came down with it. They're scavengers as well in the Ames area. And there have been mammals across the country now that, especially babies. So here we are now in the spring thinking about fox kits and coyote pups and everything. And what do coyotes and fox and some of the other animals do? But they take advantage of dead and dying animals and haul them back to the den site. And the babies then eat these diseased waterfowl And they end, the kids end up getting it. They don't have the immune system yet to fend off the disease like the adults do. The adults don't, most of the adults of most mammalian species don't tend to succumb to this. But some of the youngsters do. So there, it's still unfolding. We don't know how this is going to end. It may become what we call endemic in the environment and just something that we'll always have to deal with. It may change. We know what we dealt with the COVID, the coronavirus, right? It mutates and we have to keep having new vaccines created so we stay, don't succumb to it. So it's like that with this. And so it's just, again, knowledge is power. If you've got chickens and domestic ducks and things like that, turkeys, you'll want to take some extra precautions with them so they don't run the risk of potentially getting this.
Now, does this avian influenza affect smaller birds like cardinals or things like that?
That's a really good question. And so far, it doesn't seem to. And I honestly don't know the answer why. Again, it's unfolding. But right now, last year, when they didn't know what was going to get hit, they recommended pulling your feeders in and bird baths and everything just out of an abundance of precaution, and which I think is a good thing to follow at the beginning of any of these epidemics or pandemics. So we don't know. We'll see how this goes. But so far, it doesn't seem to. The DNR, our DNR and other states and federal agencies are continuing to do field research on this. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's going to be a study with waterfowl research this summer here in Iowa.
Well, for example, what about red-winged blackbirds that are always around in the reeds and marshes where the waterfowl are? Do we have any idea?
I don't think so. It doesn't. I mean, from what I've heard, and Jenna might correct me on this, but we've not heard that it impacts them. And again, with this field season now, mm-hmm. With the returning migrating songbirds like your red-winged blackbird, it may be while they're out looking for shorebirds and to test and everything, then they might find an occasional carcass of a red-winged blackbird or something. Those would be tested too. I'm just pretty sure about that. So could be incidental. We just don't know.
Well, what about bats then?
And what about bats?
Well, just because bats fly doesn't mean they're avian, Donna.
Well, but they're mammals, so does it pass on to bats or?
Well, that's really a good question, Donna, and one I hadn't been asked before. So good for you. So, couple of things. So HPAI can be aerosolized, so the virus can go through the air, but it's mostly transmitted through like feces and saliva. So the bats probably would have to eat, be eating on an affected carcass. Hmm. So our bats are not meat eaters, although there are some meat eating bat species in the world. Ours eat insects. Now, so they probably would not be impacted by HPAI. I always wonder, so you've got like mosquitoes that are sucking blood for some of these.
Exactly.
My brain just goes down rabbit holes. So you've got, mosquitoes sucking blood from diseased, waterfowl that have HPAI. Can that be transmitted through the blood to a bat then that's eating the mosquitoes? I have no earthly idea. So that's a really good question. I think chances would be pretty minimal on that. But and heaven only knows bats have their own issues to do
with.
Well,
I was going to say, don't we? What is the thing that's affecting the bats pretty severely globally even? There's something. Something terrible going on for the poor bats.
Right. And that would be...
White nose.
I'm getting all these confused in my head. White nose syndrome. It's geomycin's blah blah. It's a fungus
okay.
White nose fungus or white nose syndrome. And what that does is it's usually like in cave systems because it likes moist, cool environments. Kind of like highly pathogenic avian influenza. It likes moist, cool environments too. So go figure. But so white nose syndrome, once a bat gets it, once the fungus then gets a hold of the bat, the fungus is on the membranes around the mouth and on the wings, and it's real irritating to the bat. So in the wintertime, they're sleeping, they're in hibernation, and that irritation from the fungus wakes them up. And to be in hibernation, their metabolism drops way down, right? Because they don't have insects to eat. So they get roused, their metabolism then starts going sky high because they have sky high metabolism, and they waste lots of energy and basically end up starving to death. So that's, and it's killed millions of bats across the country. And some of our bats in particular, the little brown bat and the northern long-eared bat, are in big trouble.
Oh, goodness. Well, you have a bat event coming up soon. Tell us about your bat event.
Oh, it'll be fun.
Some good news here. All right.
There was a segue. I know. We do. I mean, some days you can imagine, some days we just see lots of trauma here, and we see more death than we do see life some days. But then these releases are the cause for celebration, because that's what we're here for. So we've gotten in. Jenna, how many bats have we gotten in this winter?
About 103.
103 bats so far.
How do you get the bats?
Well, people find them in their houses, actually. They will often find an attic that seems to be maybe cave-like to them at the time, and so they'll try and hibernate there. If it gets too cold, our modern houses have incredible insulation typically, right? So the attic floors are really super insulated from the rest of the house to keep the heat in the human living space. Used to be that we didn't have insulation on attic floors, and the heat would rise into the attic, and it would moderate the temperature of the attic to be more conducive to bats hibernating there. But now it just gets too cold when we have cold snaps, and that wakes the bats up. They're like Goldilocks. They want the temperatures just right in order to sleep. So they'll wake up, and they'll start crawling around the house from the attic, seeking warmer temperatures to go back to sleep. But then they end up in living spaces of the people, and it's too warm for them to go back to sleep. And so then they're flying around, and people go, oh no, there's a bat in my house. So they will often call us and say, what do we do? And if they haven't captured it already, then we guide them through how to capture it, or contacting their local animal control to help with situations like that. Again, like Lana was talking about, you never want to handle these animals barehanded for all the reasons we've already listed. So light gloves, leather gloves will usually do the trick, throwing a T-shirt over them to calm them down, and getting them in a escape-proof container, like a yogurt container. And then they get them to us. And then we have to feed them and get them rehydrated, and then we put them in slumber. We put them in hibernation for the rest of the season.
Good. Then you're going to have a bat release party.
See, you brought me back to it. Thank you. Yeah, so now we have all these bats that need to be released. And so we used to do this before the pandemic, the human pandemic. And now we're going to have a public release again, since we've not been able to hold it for the last 3 years. So we will put out announcements. We never know when this is going to take place, because it's all weather dependent. We're waiting for the insects to be available to these bats. And we're waiting for warm temperatures. And
how
so
warm
it
does it
to,
have to be?
Okay, good question. It will need to be in the 60s or 70s in the daytime. So the nighttime temperatures then are usually in the 50s and 60s. So that's sort of the earliest that we can think about releasing these bats. So that's coming up soon, but not this week. So we'll be putting out information on Facebook. People can follow us on Facebook and look for the announcements of the bat releases. And they can look at follow us on our website, www.ourwildlifecenter.org.
How do you release 103 bats?
Yeah. So
throw them out the window, right?
Yeah, right. And then run. No. So, Jenna, you said how many bats do we have?
About 25.
Yeah, we've got about 25 bats. Jenna hasn't done a bat release yet with us, and so this will be her first experience. So we've had 120 to 150 people come to these releases, so it's pretty popular. And so we do some education. We start the event like an hour before dusk, an hour before sundown, and have some educational activities for people to do and learning all about bats. And then at dusk and a little beyond, then we've got all of our bat volunteers who will be there, and we've got all the bats in little ice cream buckets. Yes, we've kept them in there individually and kept them in hibernation that way. And so we take all these buckets of bats to the release site, and all the volunteers then will, one at a time, put these bats on the side of a big, tall oak tree down at Brookside Park. Oh. And we keep the crowd back, and they can watch then the bats fly off watch them circling overhead as they get their bearings, and then they can go find their homes again.
Oh, good. You mean you don't just open up the ice cream containers and they leap out and fly away?
Bats are funny that way. They typically can't leap up like a bird would.
Uh-huh.
They typically will have to drop down. So they'll have to crawl up like a tree or something and then use that height to drop down and then start flying. They're the only truly flying mammal in the world. So they're pretty cool that way, but they usually don't have, they have really tiny legs that are all connected with membrane, skin membrane, so they don't have tall legs to stand up on to spring up and start flapping their wings. Some of the bigger, stronger adult males can jump off the ground and get flight, but usually they need to have a little help. So putting them on the side of a tree is just giving them a little help.
Good. Good information about bats. I want to mention this is KHOI Community Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. And community radio is a really good thing. It deserves your support. And I know that, Marlene, I know that you listen to this radio station.
Oh, KHOI means so much to me. I mean, I have a lot of friends who volunteer lots of time, help keeping it going. And community radio, I think, is one way we can all stay connected in a really vital way. And my husband probably listens to it live more than I do because I'm usually here taking all these wildlife calls and working on other wildlife activities. So I do listen to the podcast, though, and those are really valuable as well. I just think it's a treasure in our community and one that should be supported. So donate, people. It's awesome.
You can donate by going online to khoifm.org. It's under the membership tab, I believe.
Yes, very good, very good. So, Jenna and Marlene, can people volunteer and help your organization out?
Yeah, so we're located at 328 Main Street. It's in the same building as the downtown deli. And people can fill out an application on our website at iowawildlifecenter.org, or they can call us at 515-233-1379 to let us know they're interested. We have volunteers doing more than just animal care here. They can help with land stewardship out at our acreage called Wildway, or they can help with education programs, construction out at Wildway, so we can get our facility up and running out there. There's a lot of different opportunities too. Transport volunteers as well, if you just want to help get the animals to us. There's also those applicants as well.
Good. Good. And yes, you don't just have a presence here on Main Street. There, you'd have way too many animals to keep track of everything here. So you do have a new space, relatively new space, south of the ledges, southwest of Ames, correct?
That's correct. So it's only about 15 miles from here, and we're just about a mile, not even a mile, directly south of the Ledges State Park campground. And we own 75 acres of property there, and we call it Wildway. and we've been reconstructing and restoring the habitat there. So we just planted our last 20 acres of our prairie reconstruction project Monday, this past, no, was it two Mondays ago? I can't remember, really recently. So we have a lot of now native prairie on the site, and we've been restoring this oak savanna, and there's deep ravines, wooded ravines. It's just a really special place. So that's where we're going to eventually house our wildlife rehabilitation clinic and education center as we can financially make that happen. So our donations make all of what we do possible too. The volunteers make it possible. The donations make it possible. People seem to think it's critical to help these animals, and so it's critical that we get the help so we can keep helping.
Marlene, are you still keeping the eagles that have been lead poisoned?
No. HPAI changed a lot of things, and so we here for us in this little office space here, we don't have. It's an old office space. It has very poor ventilation for the humans, let alone for anything that might have some sort of disease. We rent five small office rooms here and in this building, and it's not conducive to really doing what we're doing. And so we need to critically get this wildlife clinic and education facility built so we can do more. So when we get calls about these injured or sick raptors, because we don't know if they have HPAI, we just chosen a basement corridor that nobody has access to in the basement of this building, and we isolate the animal there. Sometimes we'll do a swab test and send that off quickly, but then within 24 hours we just get it stabilized, and then within 24 hours at least we transfer it to a bird rehabilitator in Western Iowa, or we've got if it's passerine, we'll transfer it to a Des Moines rehabilitator who does songbirds and waterfowl. So
good.
We just don't have abilities to isolate these animals here and not run the risk of it spreading to other patients that we have.
Well, good. Sounds like you have. A lot of good service connecting us with our wild neighbors, and thank you for all your good work. My goodness, we've been talking to Marlene and Jenna from the Iowa Wildlife Center today. Thanks for joining us today. Good.
Thank you for having me.
Good. And I would like to do a little bit for Earth Day here. Earth Day is coming up this weekend. I've got a little few words from the poet, the Native American poet, N. Scott Mamaday, who has a few thoughts on the earth, and here's a little something he says. When we dance, the earth trembles. When our steps fall on the earth, we feel the shudder of life beneath us, and the earth feels the beating of our hearts. We become one with the earth. We shall not sever ourselves from the earth. We must chant our being. We must dance in time with the rhythms of the earth. We must keep the earth. Yes, thoughts for Earth Day. So, well, Donna, that was a good show.
Well, the wildlife stuff is always fascinating. I mean, you know, even here in the middle of town, there are things. Like, we had a raccoon up a tree last week. I was like, what do we do with him?
We do. And so we call Marlene and Jenna. Yes, we do. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m., or anywhere that you can get podcasts. Look for Donalana Kitchen. Support this fine community radio station. Go to khoifm.org/membership. Yes. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Music by the Barn Owl Band. Eat good food and enjoy life.